There's a possibility that MicroStrategy, now known as Strategy, reaches a $1 trillion market cap in 2025. All it takes is Elon saying, hey, we accept Bitcoin for payment again. Everybody's running around with their head cut off trying to figure out what this company's worth. A lot of people are really hesitant when looking at MicroStrategy because they've been burned by...
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Jeff Walton, also known as Punter Jeff, the MicroStrategy expert. But Jeff, I've been hearing some rumblings that you've got a very bullish prediction on MicroStrategy. So tell us, what do you think MicroStrategy is getting to in 2025? And why do you think it's getting there?
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Brandon. Happy to be here and excited to dive into this a little bit. Yeah, I've come out and I do think that there's a possibility that MicroStrategy, now known as Strategy, reaches a $1 trillion market cap in 2025. I think the way that the traditional markets are designed and structured lends itself to a significant potential increase in valuation within 2025. I mean, currently, as of today, they're valued about an $80 billion company. Last year, about a year ago, they were a $14 billion company. So they've seen a significant rise from $14 billion to $80 billion. And once you get into, you know, this territory, $100 billion plus, the amount of capital needed to push it a bit higher is, it almost becomes less and less in into the future. So what I mean by that is, a large majority of equities have passive index investments, passive flows. You've got S&P 500, QQQ, you know, all of these index funds that are buying these equities in perpetuity, right? And the way that these funds are designed, S&P 500, QQQ, they're market cap weighted index funds. So as the valuation of the company increases, the proportion of new funds that are coming in the door to buy that equity is increasing at an increasing rate. So it is exponential in and of itself, just the way that the funds are designed. Now, what makes Strategy really unique here is the potential for S&P 500 inclusion. And I think this is going to be one of the biggest topics of 2025. And with this nuclear core of Bitcoin sitting on its balance sheet, if the price of Bitcoin is greater than 96,000 at the 96,500 at the end of March, that would effectively erase MicroStrategy's negative earnings going back for the last three quarters, and thus make them qualified for the S&P 500, which is roughly 10 times larger than QQQ, the NASDAQ 100 that they were included in Q4 of 2024.
Now, it sounds like that you're telling me that there's going to be a greater than a 10x return in the next 9 months here for Strategy. Now, I know I called it MicroStrategy at the beginning, but that would be bigger than all of the return that we saw last year. So is that what you're telling me? You think the inclusion in the S&P 500 and the new, essentially, FASB would help catapult Strategy into a new stratosphere here?
It's possible. I think it is. It is totally possible. Now, the caveat, the reason I don't use share price is that there is this accretive dilution component that's happening over time as well. So Strategy is leveraging capital markets and leveraging, you know, dilution to purchase more Bitcoin and put more Bitcoin on its balance sheet. And because of that, that, you know, increases the total shares outstanding, which may have an impact on that kind of 10x figure. But I think there's a possibility, there's so many things that can happen, a macro environment, et cetera, et cetera. But the change in accounting rules, the change in accounting rules is going to result in potentially positive earnings for Strategy for the first time in the last 4 years. And they're finally able to reflect the value of the Bitcoin gain on their quarterly earnings. And, you know, if the price of Bitcoin goes to 100,000 by the end of March, all of a sudden you're looking at a multi-billion-dollar net income gain in Q1. And this is going to be the first time that a majority of the traditional financial world will have seen Strategy at all. There is, you know, a large portion of the world that has no idea that there's a single company out there that's holding $50 billion worth of Bitcoin let alone that $50 billion being, you know, 10x more the next closest company. So people are largely unaware, like the traditional finance world is largely unaware that Bitcoin is a $2 trillion asset. There's companies that are capitalizing their company on it. And that adoption of FASB fair value accounting and potentially having a really large net income gain in a single quarter is, I don't think there's going to be an instant repricing of strategy. However, I think there's going to be this long-term perception, perceptual change that people are going to start rethinking and start to understand what's going on with strategy for the very first time. You know, a lot of fanatics, people that have been following Bitcoin are have been following strategy and think it's the best thing since sliced bread, myself included. And the reality is there's a very, very small portion of the world that has any understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah, so let's dive into that because, you know, it seems like there is a lot of volume when it comes to strategy. It's getting essentially traded on a daily basis like one of the Magnificent Seven. And, you know, if you look at the market cap, it's significantly less than all of that. So, you know, why do you think less companies haven't really developed this strategy yet? And do you think that that'll start to change as we see, you know, strategy potentially make some waves here in the next, whether it's at the end of this quarter when they report earnings or throughout the rest of this year?
Yeah, there's a couple things there. So strategy has basically been a top 10 publicly traded equity by volume for about the last 70 days in a row, maybe 75 days in a row. And when you look at where they rank in the publicly traded leaderboard, I think they're 120th largest publicly traded company. Now you start to compare that, right? I mean, you're like, wait, what's going on here? If you're the top 10 publicly traded equity by volume, but you're the 120th largest company, what's the reason for that? And the reason for that is the fact that the stock itself is incredibly volatile. And so you have, you know, funds and companies that are trading the stock, you know, back and forth intraday, right? Buying, selling, buying, selling. You've got these arb traders that are going back and forth into IBIT, in and out of IBIT, in and strategy and out. And there are infinite strategies that you can run to potentially profit on the strategy trade, whether it's a pair with Bitcoin, whether it's a, you know, long short between MSTU and MSTR, which is like the 2x leverage. There's covered call strategies, MSTY. You've got just infinite strategies that you could potentially run on the strategy equity itself because of the volatility. Now, your question on whether other companies will adopt this, I think most of the large companies that already exist, like Mag7, they have zero incentive to do this, right? They've already been incredibly profitable doing what they're doing, and they have very little incentive today to, you know, adopt a full Bitcoin treasury strategy full bore. Now, that being said, there are hundreds and thousands of other companies that are really struggling in the capital markets environment to raise future capital. And something like a Bitcoin treasury strategy could be that jolt to the balance sheet that really helps them raise future capital. And the reason I say that is if you think about the economic environment, right? Let's just say I've got a local biotech here in the Pacific Northwest. Their stock went up to $6 billion and came back down. And right now the company's worth $400 million. And they're kind of struggling. And so you got two options. One, you could go out to the market and you could raise debt capital. And that debt capital is going to come with a 10 to 12 interest rate. Or you can issue stock, but your valuation's depressed. So that's not going to make the employees feel great. So you're kind of a rock and a hard place where you can't raise capital. The macro environment isn't great. You don't want to issue shares. People don't really want to work for you. They're kind of demoralized on the equity pricing, equity valuation. And all of a sudden, companies that are in this situation may turn to Bitcoin and may look for this other capital source that can give them the volatility and the jolt that they need in order to raise more capital or recapitalize their company in a different format. So I think that's where this industry is going. And I think some corporations will be forced to take action in that way. I don't think interest rates are going to come down drastically anytime soon. I mean, they might come down 100 basis points or something like that, but still the cost of capital is going to be relatively high moving forward, really.
Now, with that, do you think that the traditional, I guess, equity evaluations, everything like that, do you think they've figured out strategy or MSTR how to value it yet?
Absolutely not. There, everybody's running around with their head cut off trying to figure out what this company's worth, right? There are bears on both sides of the aisle. And what's happening here is you've got these two parts of the world. You got this traditional finance part of the world who thinks Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme and is tulip bulbs. And then you've got this Bitcoin side of the world that is a full Bitcoin only. There shouldn't be any leverage in the system. And they don't understand leverage in traditional finance. And now you've got this, you know, cohort in between that understands, you know, Bitcoin, and they understand traditional finance, and they understand how the two can be merged. So you've got this very small group of people that have a future understanding of what this company could potentially be when you think about the power of unencumbered capital. And the world at large is really trying to figure out a new framework for valuing this company as well. So a lot of people are pointing to this MNAV, multiple net asset value, saying that Strategy is just a Bitcoin ETF and it should trade at 1x its net asset value. And I think that's just fundamentally flawed because all stocks are forward looking, right? If you look at Apple or Nvidia or any of these other top publicly traded companies, they're 10, 15, 20 years forward looking in their pricing valuations from a traditional perspective. Now, if you take that same framework and you look at a company like Strategy, what is the value of Bitcoin in 10 years? Is it $3 million per Bitcoin? Well, if that's the case, Strategy's assets would be worth, $1.5 trillion, the assets alone. And if that's the case, I think Strategy should be valued at $1.5 trillion or something to that regard. And I think a lot of the reason for this or the valuations of existing traditional financial companies is because of the design of the market. Kind of circling back to the very first topic, you've got the S&P 500 and QQQ and these index funds make up a very large portion of the holdings of some of these larger companies. So like Apple, for example, S&P 500 holds 6% of Apple. That didn't exist. Apple's not a $3 trillion company. And so because it exists, that's capital that's sitting there and it's not moving ever. And the traditional financial world just wraps their head around a valuation of $3 trillion that makes it make sense. And so what I think will happen, Strategy potentially gets included in the S&P 500. We're going to start to see a valuation potentially increase, and it's going to be beyond rationality. People are going to try to, put MNAV to it or put PE ratios to it, and it's going to be really difficult to rationalize. But my fundamental thesis is, like, how do you compare, some of the top publicly traded equities to each other? Like, how do you compare JP Morgan and Apple or Exxon or Tesla? Like, how do you compare them? They all have different fundamental financial structures. They have different products. They have different moats. They have different environments that they work in. And really the only comparable metric is market cap. And, I think when I look at Strategy's market cap and I see them trading around CVS and Chipotle, my only response to that is it's going higher. Like, Bitcoin is more valuable than $5 guacamole, right? Like, it's going higher. And that's my primary rationalization. I'm going to hold it until I think it's valued appropriately. And I think valued appropriately is at the top of the publicly traded leaderboard.
So does that mean that we'll see potentially Strategy, if other major companies with higher market caps, Strategy pass all of these guys, like the Metas, the Nvidias, the Amazons of the world?
Yeah, I think it's highly likely. Not this year, right? And it might be 8 years or 12 years from now. But when I look at some of the Mag 7, I think the Mag 7 is a great trade, right? These companies are incredibly powerful. They've got AI. They're just fundamentally rooted into culture. Like, I've got an iPhone, That being said, some of their valuations are really hard to wrap your head around. And when you know, 8-10 years from now, when Bitcoin's trading consistently at $1 million plus and Strategy's got, you know, 750,000 to 1 million Bitcoin on their balance sheet, I think it's going to be one of the only valuations that really makes sense, right? Like, it's going to be one of the only valuations where you're going to be able to wrap your head around the capital that they hold and their financial strength as a function of, you know, how many assets they hold, their relative debt, and like what they can potentially do, the productivity of those assets. And, you know, I mean, you think about other companies like Apple and Tesla, but the value of the company is the productivity of their assets. Like, how productive is the company? And it looks different.
Yeah. And something that Jeff Booth always says that always has kind of resonated with me is that it's difficult to price the new system in the old system. Now, do you think that this is kind of, I guess, resonating with companies now holding Bitcoin on the balance sheet? Like, how do you price, how do you evaluate a Strategy in using the traditional metrics, whether it's PE or, you know, some of these other value investing metrics that always get tossed around? It's like, essentially, that's what's going on here, is that people don't know how to react. One, because they don't know how to value Bitcoin. And two, they don't know how to value companies with Bitcoin on the balance sheet.
Right. Yeah. Jeff Booth has nailed it on the head, right? You've got two separate systems, two separate rulers, right? Like, you've got a fiat ruler, and then you've got a Bitcoin ruler, and you know how you measure those companies looks fundamentally different. And when you start to look at like the Mag 7 being worth, I don't know, 98 million Bitcoin in total, right? If you were to combine all of the Mag 7 in terms of market cap, it's worth something like 98 million Bitcoin. And you're like, hold on. if using my Bitcoin ruler, that looks incredibly overvalued, because there can only be 21 million Bitcoin. There's two ways to look at that, right? Either Mag 7 is incredibly overvalued or Bitcoin is incredibly undervalued. One of those is true. So I, you know, it'll be interesting to see the world kind of figure that out and put those two things together. And ultimately, there are other reasons for, you know, holding these types of assets too, right? Like, people hold equities as a store of value. And if you start to see utility potentially increase in the future with these equities, it could result in future use cases as well.
Now, obviously, Saylor has kind of invented that, I like to call, or, you know, it's been coined, the MicroStrategy flywheel, right? Obviously, the Strategy flywheel now, but essentially, you know, being able to borrow a bunch of money in order to buy more Bitcoin. Now, do we get to the point where they're, one, not going to be able to sustain this debt, and two, potentially, that Strategy has too much Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's a good question. So sustained debt and too much Bitcoin. Yeah. So good questions. I think when you have a leveraged Bitcoin equity strategy, like Strategy does, risk management is incredibly important. And I think that's something that a lot of people are really hesitant, right? A lot of people are really hesitant when looking at MicroStrategy, because they've been burned by FTX, they've been burned by BlockFi, they've been burned by Celsius. You've got these companies that are running, you know, banks that, you know, weren't appropriately managing their risk, or didn't have any risk framework in place to manage any downside, anything like that. And now you've got a company like Strategy that's incredibly public about how much Bitcoin they hold, how many assets they hold, what's their debt, what's their liability, what's their target liability, debt coverage ratio. And when you look at the company right now, they've got about $50 billion worth of assets, and they've got about $8 billion worth of debt. So their asset to debt liability ratio is something like 19%, 19 or 20%. So in order for the assets of the company to be worth less than the debt, which is just a simple metric, the price of Bitcoin, we need to go down to 17,500. And I think that's a valuable risk framework to stay within, right? Like, if anybody thinks about the price of Bitcoin going down to 17,500, you know, people are selling, you know, their cousin's children, right? You're selling your dog to go buy more Bitcoin, like kidneys, blood, like whatever you're doing, you're doing it to go buy more Bitcoin, and you're levering up your house and all of that stuff. So I think it's incredibly unlikely. Additionally, when you think about the framework of how strategy is designed, the debt isn't tied to any of their Bitcoin or any EBITDA constraints or anything like that. So the convertible debt is really a function of the corporate balance sheet. It has nothing to do with the Bitcoin. So, for example, there is no margin call, right? There's not a Bitcoin price where if Bitcoin hits that price, like Strategy has to liquidate any of their Bitcoin. It doesn't exist. And I think that's something a lot of the bears, like Wall Street Journal, thinks that, you know, it's going to be margin called. Like a lot of people think this is going to end poorly. But with the way that they've structured the debt, it's, you know, long-term instruments, unencumbered capital, and they're effectively using their corporate balance sheet as collateral in that transaction. The debt holders are underwriting Sailor and the Strategy team, not the Bitcoin. And so I think it's incredibly unlikely that they're over leveraged at any point. And I think they can continue to manage that leverage into time. I mean, they just raised $20 billion in Q4 to buy more Bitcoin, and it totally deleveraged the balance sheet. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems like, you know, everybody keeps buying into this equity, including, you know, the big players like BlackRock. And recently BlackRock filed to own, you know, 5% of Strategy. Now, yeah. Is this something that, you know, either one comes with the territory with the new debt equity of the STRK, if you want to kind of dive into what that is? And two, is this something that potentially worries you with a lot of the big dogs coming in like BlackRock? You know, we've got the Norwegian pension fund, people with a lot of money essentially now funding this and scooping up the Bitcoin indirectly through Sailor. Is that a worry of yours as well?
Yeah, that's not a worry of mine as well. I think a lot of these asset managers or these big funds that you're seeing that are on the 13Fs when those filings come out, like BlackRock or even Cantor Fitzgerald, these Norwegian funds, they're buying those positions on behalf of the people that are purchasing their funds. So if they're purchasing QQQ or a QQQ tracking fund, NASDAQ 100 tracking fund, you're having capital come in the door from alternative locations, and that capital is then being used to, you know, purchase all the equities that follows the fund. So I think a majority of that capital that you see in some of those large 13F filings, like Vanguard, for example, owns a ton of Strategy. It's from, you know, a Russell 2000 index fund or a QQQ index fund or, you know, other avenues like that. But, you know, I don't think that is an issue really, because these corporations or these companies that are purchasing Strategy, they're purchasing it as a diversification play, right? If you're a large scale asset manager, all large scale asset managers currently subscribe to Markowitz Modern Portfolio Theory, which is like the efficient frontier of assets and effectively the math behind diversification. So if you have a portfolio of diversified assets, if you add a new asset to that portfolio that's got alternative risk return metrics, that improves the return and reduces the risk of the entire portfolio. So now you have an asset like Strategy, which is incredibly volatile, but also incredibly high performing. And so if you have, or Bitcoin's the same way, which has got a really high Sharpe ratio, meaning that it's very productive. It's a very productive to add to a diversified mixed portfolio of assets. In small quantities, right? Like you can add 1-2% to your portfolio and actually makes your portfolio, you know, perform really well into the future. So I think that's happening on a large scale, and we'll continue to see it happen a bit more and more as institutions begin to wrap their heads around what's happening here. And, you know, with the potential S&P 500 inclusion, there's about $10 trillion in the market that follows S&P 500 index funds. So, you know, you could be looking at a $10 billion of new capital coming in the door to buy Strategy if they do get included in the S&P 500, which is a big potential inflow of capital.
Yeah, and so with that, you know, I brought up the STRK. So if you could explain a little bit about that and kind of how the, like, what that is, and then why it's only offered to, I guess, the big dogs.
Yeah. So STRK, so there's a few things that Strategy is doing to effectively provide Bitcoin exposure to different capital pools. Like that's generally what Strategy is doing right now, right? They've offered convertible debt to the market where they're saying, okay, we'll offer you this debt transaction that's got debt downside and equity upside. And there's this pool of capital out there in the world where they have this mandate where all they can do is buy convertible debt, right? If these convertible debt ARB guys wanted to go buy equity, just standard equity, they wouldn't be able to do it. So Sailor has found this pool of capital and said, hey, we'll give you Bitcoin exposure in the form of convertible debt through Strategy's balance sheet. And so that's convertible debt market. And now preferred shares. So you think about capital structure of a company, debt. So capital structure is important when you're thinking about potential bankruptcy proceedings. So that's where this kind of comes into play. Debt sits at the very top. So if there's a bankruptcy, debt holders get paid first. Okay. Then preferred shareholders and then common equity holders. So debt is the least risky. You also have the least upside. Preferred stock, which is second in the door, is medium risky, medium upside. And then the third is common equity, which is the most risky, but also most upside. Basically, you carry all the excess risk. And so the preferred stock, Sailor and the Strategy team identified this alternative pool of capital that for example, preferred stock ETFs. There's a big pool of preferred stock ETFs out there in the market where all they do is they have the mandate to purchase preferred stock. So Sailor said, okay, let's design some preferred stock that's got a dividend on it. It's got an 8% fixed dividend based on our initial target price. And we'll go offer that preferred stock to the market. We'll raise capital today and go buy more Bitcoin with it and provide this new form of equity to this different pool of capital that's got reduced upside and reduced downside because it's got the dividend payment on it. And so that's effectively what Strategy is doing. It's, you know, tapping these different pools of capital, offering them de facto Bitcoin exposure in reduced volatility forms. And the common stock equity holder is taking that excess volatility. They benefit from taking the excess volatility from the convertible debt holders and the preferred stock holders. And your point on, you know, only big dogs can buy it. Really, anybody can go buy preferred stock, right? The stock is publicly traded. You could go to any brokerage account and purchase it today. There was an initial IPO and you needed to have, I think, $25,000 or more in order to get the IPO. But anybody can go buy the stock today. So if you're interested in reduced upside and a dividend payment coming in annually, it's less than 8% now, but 8% fixed on $80 stock price, that could be of interest.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens. You flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks. 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage, and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that's self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show. I gotcha. I guess I misunderstood here. This is why I needed to have you on the show, Jeff, so I can understand a lot of these things. But, you know, we're starting to see, you know, Saylor get very publicized with, you know, his Bitcoin holdings and everything else. What impact do you think that that has just on strategy as, you know, it's seemingly Saylor's star continues to rise here? Do you hold any weight into that at all?
With the Saylor premium?
Yeah, basically.
The Saylor premium. I mean, obviously, Saylor is a huge advocate for Bitcoin. I mean, he's starting to dip his toe into the political sphere and the political realm. He's going to be presenting at the I guess, crypto summit tomorrow at the White House. He's going to be at the Capitol in a couple of weeks talking about Bitcoin and Bitcoin advocacy. And I mean, he's really plugged into the community. I guess I don't necessarily see that as a risk because they do have a very strong team that's running behind the scenes, the capital team that's actually structuring and designing the deals and running the Bitcoin strategy. And, you know, I think it's having Saylor at the helm or the chairman position is certainly it deserves a premium because their team works together in identifying this strategy moving forward.
Okay, now with that, I have a little thought experiment for you. Before we get into the potential of other companies coming on board, I do think that there is one person that could dethrone Michael Saylor as the biggest Bitcoin bull, and that is Mark Zuckerberg here. Before you tell me I'm crazy, he does have more voting rights than Michael Saylor does currently. For Correct. Meta, obviously. And so if he wanted to implement a Bitcoin strategy, he could easily do that here. And it seems like, you know, the Magnificent Seven has had a couple. Obviously, we saw Microsoft shoot it down drastically, but we've got Amazon potentially voting on it and Meta tossing around the idea as well. Do you see that it's a possibility, one of Mark Zuckerberg potentially being a bigger Bitcoin bull than Michael Saylor? And two, having multiple or at least one Magnificent Seven company develop this strategy?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I speculated on Meta for really the last couple quarters as well. I think Meta's got, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think about $50 billion in cash on hand. So if they did adopt a Bitcoin treasury strategy, it's possible that they could buy enough to potentially catch strategy. However, they would have had to start today and doing it under the cover of darkness and not tell anybody that they're doing it and all of a sudden come out and say that they have 500,000 Bitcoin. I think it's highly unlikely that that's the case. I think if they did anything, it would probably dip their toe in the water. But I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing, you know, Bitcoin being the native internet currency for some of these AI models or these AI tools that are coming into the scene here. But I mean, you mentioned Mag 7, right? Like Tesla already holds 10,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And all it takes is Elon saying, hey, we accept Bitcoin for payment again for our Tesla cars. And all of a sudden, they're going to start having Bitcoin come in the door and potentially thinking about that a bit differently as well. And, you know, if the US government starts adding it to their balance sheet, I think you're going to see it come into the conversation a lot more. And it will be more top of mind to some of these companies about like, why are we doing this? Who's doing what? What's going on? Who's a leader in this space? And people are going to be looking for the leaders, right? Like who's leading the charge here? And just given where Saylor's been and how he's been, you know, on the podcast circuit for years. Right, going back and forth, you know, on all of these different episodes, talking about novel ideas, talking about different perspectives, history of money, getting into the history of like the world, and I don't think anybody's going to catch him from that perspective. That he's got 5 years of content already out on the internet with millions of views, and really leading the thought charge there in the market.
Yeah, the only reason I think that Zuckerberg could maybe or maybe would be primed to do it is just because of this recent rebranding we've got. You know, we've seen him growing out the hair a little bit.
I do love it. Yeah. So he's like knows? Surfing, holding a American flag, cracking a beer on the 4th of July. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, we got Sailor super fans out there that, you know, listen to every podcast and, you know, really hang on every word. And, you know, we've got people like yourself talking about MSTR on a daily basis almost. So with that, you it would drive more attention to Meta and maybe be the full circle rebranding that Mark Zuckerberg's really looking for. But that's all speculation here.
Yeah.
What isn't speculation is we are seeing more MicroStrategy copycats. Now, we had one in Brazil pop up today. I don't know if you got a chance to look at it. But we've got MetaPlanet, we've got Semler Scientific, some of these other smaller companies really starting to get onto it. So how big of an impact do you think that's going to make on the overall market? One, as just for Bitcoin only, and then two, you know, looking at other companies, you know, we talked about the Mag 7, but maybe some other bigger names potentially getting into it.
Yeah, I think in 2025, we're going to have one. I think there's going to be one company that surprises us that comes out and says that they're adopting a Bitcoin treasury strategy. And I think it's going to wow everybody. I don't know anything. I think that's just my speculation. We're going to see like a $25 billion company come out and adopt a Bitcoin treasury strategy. And everybody's going to say like, whoa, where did that come from? I think that's inevitable. I think probably going to happen. But you know, I was just in New York this last week speaking with folks, and I think one of the things that I'm a bit more excited about is some of the smaller private companies that are considering a Bitcoin treasury strategy, because you don't need board approval, right? It's just different, you know, different approval process with a private company. You've got less decision makers potentially involved. And you've got these companies that are starting to think of their corporate treasury in Bitcoin terms. And that's just fundamentally changing the way that these people think. And I think some grassroots movement in the private market is going to catch a lot of people by storm as well. So I'm really excited about the future. I mean, we're going to see a dozen companies come out running a Bitcoin treasury strategy, or at least adding Bitcoin to their balance sheet, thinking about I have to do this. Like I have to add Bitcoin to my balance sheet in preservation of my corporation, right? I've got capital, I've got cash that's burning on my balance sheet and just totally melting. And if I don't do something with it, it's just going to be useless, right? It's the same quandary that the strategy was in back in 2020. They had $500 million of cash and they had to figure out what to do with it. So, you know, they went and explored like, okay, does buying commercial real estate work? No, everybody's at home, COVID. Okay, well, can I buy, well, I can't buy equities with this because that, you know, it's not allowed. I got to buy treasuries. Well, inflation is running rampant. Like where do I park this money? I don't want to push it in straight into R&D because I don't know what the future looks like, really uncertain. And I think it's likely that we're going to see inflation continue right into the future. And that's going to be unfortunate for a lot of people, unless you're owning hard assets or strong capital. And, I think there's going to be a significant push for these corporations to rethink their capital structure, how they're designed, and shift forward into the 21st century, because it's negligent to ignore Bitcoin at this point. It's the seventh largest asset on the planet. It's a $2 trillion market cap. It's the largest computer network on the planet. And people are literally quitting their jobs to go work on developing and expanding the Bitcoin ecosystem, myself and, you know, many others. And it's too big to ignore at this point. And you're doing your shareholders a disservice by not exploring the possibility of adding Bitcoin to your balance sheet, even just small proportions. I don't think every corporation on the planet should be doing the strategy playbook. I don't think that makes sense for everybody, but having greater than zero exposure to Bitcoin, I think every corporation on the planet should be doing that.
But Jeff, we crashed to 86,000. Pack it up, man. Let's go home. I mean, it's yeah. over, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, that's tongue in cheek here. But
well,
I mean,
on that point, if you rethink of Bitcoin as a duration asset, and just forget about the daily volatility, just know that it's globally liquid, tradable 24/7, 365. And if I hold it for four or five years. The likelihood that I have positive compound annual growth rate on the Bitcoin that I hold is incredibly high. And if there's any sort of DCA and hold for 4+ years, the CAGR is greater than zero, right? It's going to outperform the treasury. So anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, you're fine, man. Yeah. And as Michael Saylor famously put, if you hold Bitcoin for 4 years or longer, nobody's ever lost money, right? So, I think that you're nailing it on the head here. It's just not a lot of people have essentially seen that just yet. But we are seeing some corporations start to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet, and we've seen the large corporations, the large money managers start to create ETF products. BlackRock specifically just came out and said their model portfolio, you should have at least 1-2% in that model portfolio, which, you know, billions of dollars follow. So, yeah. You know, with that, how significant do you think it was for these ETF products to come online? And, you know, as we're sitting here, you know, a year and a couple months into it, how big of an impact do you think that has made on the overall Bitcoin market?
I mean, totally monumental, right? Prior to the ETFs existing, if you wanted to go buy Bitcoin, you had to go trust this company called Coinbase or Binance to go buy Bitcoin. You had to go to this company you never heard of, all of your bank account information, wire money over to Coinbase, and then you have all this information. Like, okay, I could hold it with the exchange. They're the custodian. What is a custodian? What is a hot wallet? What is a cold wallet? What is a Bitcoin transaction? How do I move it? Why are there fees? You had to just learn so many things. And for people that don't have time, that was a huge hurdle. And now you can go smash buy Bitcoin via a BlackRock product tradable in my existing brokerage account. I don't even need to move any money. Holy shit. Game changer, right? Total game changer. Like, yeah, boom, I'm adding it to my brokerage account. I want some Bitcoin exposure. Now I don't have to figure out any of this other bullshit out. And I know that BlackRock is a reputable name in the market. And boom, Bob's your uncle. I've got Bitcoin on my balance sheet. Now, I think to your point, some of the things I'm more excited about is I think we're going to start seeing it incorporated into target date funds. And the people that buy the target date funds aren't even going to know, right? You're just going to have Bitcoin ETFs going to make up 1% of the target date fund. Boom. All right. Well, now you've had everybody and their mother that owns a target date ETF in their 401k just bought Bitcoin. They don't even know it yet. Alternatively, you've got other products like BlackRock. I think they also include Bitcoin in one of their target bond funds. I think it's, you know, 80 or like 96% bonds, 4% Bitcoin. And so now you think about insurance companies, pension funds, anybody that's buying like a duration bond fund is now looking at having Bitcoin exposure via that vehicle to provide an asset match to a duration liability, which is, it solves so many problems in the financial world, right? They're like many of the challenges in the financial world is you've got this duration problem. In the insurance market, in the pension fund market, you have to calculate, you know, how long are my liabilities and try to make sure that you have assets that match that future liability. And one of the big problems right now is pension funds, including Social Security, are incredibly underfunded. Right. Like they have these huge liabilities and they have no idea how they're going to pay for them. Thinking about Social Security, one of the only ways you pay for it is you print more money, right? Like you print more money to satisfy your obligation. Now, private pension funds or state pension funds don't have that luxury. So how do you get there? How do you make up this big shortfall in this potential liability that you have on your balance sheet? And you've got to rethink the asset classes that you're invested in, right? Like you can't be 80% equities, 20% bonds anymore. You have to think about all the entire world of assets, and you have to have exposure to the entire world of assets, or else you're going to get run over. And Bitcoiners are going to eat the world, and like traditional finance hasn't figured it out yet. They will, they're going to get punched in the face, but it'll take a little bit of time.
Yeah, so with that, let's dive into more of that. Why do you think the traditional financial world is going to get punched in the face? Is it just going to be like, you know, by the time they figure out Bitcoin and see all the capabilities here, it's going to be, you know, the kind of you get the Bitcoin at the price you deserve and Bitcoin's at $1 million, $2 million, $10 million a coin?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. I'm just writing down some notes.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
So I've worked in traditional finance for the last 11 years. So I've got a unique perspective on the people that work in this environment, and huge egos, the entire market, huge egos. Additionally, the people that work in this industry and that have worked in the traditional finance industry, they've done really well in the existing system. Like if you work in finance, it's not a surprise. Like you get paid well. If you work in finance, you get paid really well. The work is incredibly hard. You're working hard, long hours. You get paid well, but everybody's doing really well in the existing system. They have no incentive to rethink the fact that the system might be broken. Zero incentive. So when you start to bring up an alternative reality that there's the dollar is getting debased greater than CPI, or you know, some of these facts that we've seen over the last couple of years, it's hard for them to conceptualize, easy to laugh off, and it's easy to shirk and just not pay attention to it. Especially when you see, like in the news, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you see FTX crash, crypto collapse, like Bitcoin crashes to 82,000, right? Like these are the things that hit the news, and that's the things that most of these people see. And when they see volatility, their, you know, their heart and their emotion instantly goes to 2008, 2009 financial crisis. And they're like, I never want to experience anything like that again. I don't want to be a part of something that's going to crash and burn. So they just stop right there, and they don't go any further. And that's fine. That's okay. But the real challenge is these people, these managers that are managing capital into perpetuity, insurance companies, pension funds, they have a duty to explore these assets, because if you miscalculate inflation or debasement by 25 basis points, your business model doesn't work, right? And you're not going to know it until you're dead, right? Like if your calculations are off, you got to wait 6 years to find out that your calculations are off. And you're like, holy shit, I was off by 25 basis points 6 years ago. And now my company is insolvent. Doesn't work anymore. And at that point, those corporations need to rethink, like, okay, how do I survive? How do I get out of this? What do I do? How do I reshape my company? And that moment's coming. I think it's on the horizon, but, the pain hasn't been painful enough yet.
Yeah, it's because the inflationary pressures of everything are just sending all these companies, it seems like, sky high. Now, I want to dive into that a little bit more because, you know, one of my favorite websites is govflation.com. Now, if you look at that website, it shows you the way that you know, CPI was calculated pre-change of basket of goods, like post-gold standard. So, you know, if you look at that, I think it was December or January, we're still sitting over 10% inflation according to the old way they calculated CPI, but we're under 3, at least according to the current basket of goods. Now, with this data manipulation and what we're seeing, it seems like we're sitting on a basket of cards, and the big thing that's going to collapse here, or we're sitting on a house of cards, the big thing that's going to collapse is traditional finance, because they've evaluated things essentially with just bad data. And So is that something, as somebody who's coming from that world, you see as almost like the writing on the wall here?
Yes. Absolutely. And you look back at historical money supply, Fed M2 data, St. Louis Fed data, the last 30 years have had a 6.5 or 7% compound annual growth rate in the money supply. And you go compare that to just CPI data on government websites, and there's a delta of 350 basis points. Where does that go? Right. And you've got, insurance companies, when they reinsurance companies, when they go and they look at valuing the probability of a portfolio loss and its impact into the future and inflation into the future, they're looking at CPI figures or a function of CPI figures, like rebuilding costs, you know, all those things. And I think that the industry at large has missed the debasement delta. So that the delta between CPI and money supply change. And there are companies that have missed that larger than others, and they're going to feel the pain first. So my background being in the insurance market, the market's incredibly dynamic, right? There's thousands of insurance companies all vying for the same business and competing for the same business. So you've got like these large companies that are able to outprice and outperform some of these smaller insurance companies. So everybody's got to figure out ways to cut costs, and they do it by cutting their CPI calculations or making adjustments to their pricing mechanisms that are underpricing and undervaluing the potential risk, the downside risk into, the next 4, 5, 8, 10 years.
Yeah. So with that, it seems like the last time in 2008, right, everybody got scared because, that was the most recent crash that we've all lived through. But that seemed to be, I guess, caused by banks loaning out people from the housing market. Now, how are you viewing this overall economic situation now? And is this a scenario where, because we're basically undervaluing or undermining, I don't know if that's a great word for this, but essentially just undershooting the amount of inflation right now, that this next potential crash, if there is one, could be caused by the traditional financial system and just, a big giant stock market crash like we've never seen before?
It's tough to say from my vantage point. Just looking at the insurance market, which is where I'm an expert in, if anything breaks there, I think it's more of a slow, it's like a slow burn kind of thing. But what I think may happen is we see cost of insurance outpace inflation by 2x, 3x as the market tries to reprice risk in all these different jurisdictions. There's going to be political hurdles every like along the way. It's going to be really difficult for the market to price some of that risk appropriately. So, it's a really difficult question to kind of wrap your head around. I don't think it's impossible, but you start to look at valuations of things around the world, like and rationalize it relative to interest rates and all these other things. And you look at just like the housing market. And I mean, in my neck of the woods, the housing market is incredibly high, right? Like the cost of homes is incredibly high. And we saw the cost of capital go from zero to, whatever it is now, 500 basis points. And the 30-year treasury is at, or the 30-year mortgage rate is at 6.5 or 7%. And the price of the homes hasn't adjusted, even though, the cost of capital has increased drastically. So I'm confused on who's buying these homes and like how those markets are still operating and functional, despite the relative change in valuation And yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around. I mean, there's so many moving pieces, but the one thing I do feel comfortable holding in my portfolio here is Bitcoin, because I think it's undervalued and it's like the vacuum that captures any potential inflationary pressures. And to me, it is a risk off asset to hold on my balance sheet. So I feel comfortable with that.
Hey, I hear you on that. And I've got the theory that I think we might be in somewhat of an asset bubble, because I see the same thing. Generally I'm in Tampa majority of the time, and the Tampa housing market has seen the homes double in 5 years. Right. Yeah. And it's like, all right, it doesn't make any logical sense. Like, you're not making twice as much money by living in Tampa, Florida, as you were 5 years ago. But, you know, the housing prices has doubled in 5 years. And for a housing market, that's absolutely insane, especially with, you know, we're not seeing the interest rates of homes be at 2.75 or 2.5 anymore. So, you know, all this stuff seems to me like it's recipe for some sort of pop. Now, I agree with you. I think, you know, companies like MicroStrategy holding Bitcoin on the balance sheet, I've missed the boat potentially on that, because I'm not holding MicroStrategy. Maybe you're convincing me to do that. But Bitcoin seems to be like my safe haven, where I could put it there and not need to think about it. Now, with that, do you think that the market has priced Bitcoin efficiently with the way that we are seeing everything? Obviously, you know, we're talking here and it's crashed below 90,000. But yeah, how are you valuing Bitcoin relative to, I guess, like traditional financial metrics and all that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look back in history, you look at the price of an average home relative to the price of Bitcoin, and homes are going down in value relative to Bitcoin every 4 years. So what was it? 4 years ago, the price of an average home was, I don't know, 7 Bitcoin, and now it's 4, right? And it's starting to continuing to go down over time. So I zoom out and I look at Bitcoin as an asset class, right? You've got a $2 trillion asset, and it's got potential to fit in portfolios and be a $10, $20, $30 trillion asset. So for me, again, I feel it is like the safe haven in my portfolio. Like I can panic sell it any day of the week, any time of the day, 24/7, 365, and have finality and move it. And that's worth a lot to me, right? I mean, it's a valuable position to have in my portfolio. So, yeah, I'm in agreement with you. I think there's some frothiness in other assets elsewhere, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's almost like I do believe that we've had a recession like the last year. It's just common indicators that indicate that we've been in a recession haven't been there, right? Like the stock market's been all-time highs, right? And it's almost like there's a melt up instead of a melt down in terms of economic recession.
Yeah, and it's some, you know, economists that I've heard have actually said the same thing, but not the majority of people in traditional finance kind of, I guess, negate that and say that, you know, we haven't really been in a recession just yet. So I think it is, you know, kind of an interesting time with the overall macro environment. But one thing I do know is that I think that, well, I guess it might be speculative because I haven't talked to the guy himself personally, but I think Trump looks at the overall stock market and the markets to look at how people are judging the overall economy, even though it's not necessarily one-to-one. And I think the unique thing of Trump coming in is that I think he looks at the price of Bitcoin to say, hey, the younger generation is looking at the price of Bitcoin to see how the overall economy is doing. Now, how big of a push do you think Trump coming into office and all of these new policy changes are for Bitcoin, whether it's, you know, the FASB, the SAB 121, you know, potentially we're getting a strategic reserve announced tomorrow with this White House crypto summit. I know Howard or Lutnick has, you know, kind of hinted at that. So, you know, how big do you think that this plays an impact on the overall, like, just Bitcoin market and, you know, companies potentially embracing Bitcoin as well?
It's huge. I think it's massive. you know, politically, I think there is a chance that we do get a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I'm not going to speculate on it, and I'm not going to, you know, count on it. I don't think Bitcoin needs it. If anything, it's just more bull fuel. It's jet fuel to push it into the stratosphere, right? Like U.S. buying a million Bitcoin. Yeah, that's going to be good for Bitcoin. Nobody needs to speculate on that. And I'll just wait until they do it. But some of the more important things for Bitcoin and how it interacts with the world, I think have happened with this administration, particularly with the SEC removing regulatory framework, right? So SAB 121, repealing SAB 121 and moving forward with this SAB 122 framework is incredibly important for the future of Bitcoin. And the reason is banks can now custody Bitcoin. And this is massive, right? Like if you think about, you know, how corporations work, right? If you want to increase corporate adoption of Bitcoin, you need to allow the corporations to work with the companies that they already work with. So like Meta, for example, let's just say they use Wells Fargo Bank. I have no clue what bank they use, but let's just say Wells Fargo holds 100% of their cash. They're not going to just instantly wire all of that money from Wells Fargo over to Coinbase to go smash buy Bitcoin. Not going to happen. But if Wells Fargo starts to offer Bitcoin custody solutions and like says, hey, we can actually now hold some of your cash in Bitcoin, and we can also help you, you can use those pile of assets to get a line of credit off of holding these assets. All of a sudden, that completely changes the game. It changes the utility of holding Bitcoin. And that is not priced in. Like the market hasn't figured that out yet. Traditional finance hasn't figured that out yet. It's going to develop and evolve over the next four to eight years, assuming this framework continues to be allowed moving forward into the future. But I'm incredibly bullish and excited about that future, right? If you start to see these like wrapped products where Bitcoin is being wrapped into traditional financial instruments, for example, HELOCs, and now you have a Bitcoin and home equity line of credit with two forms of collateral in one transaction, that becomes incredibly appealing from an underwriter's perspective. Like that looks like a really good risk. I can minimize my downside, right? Like if the housing market pops for whatever reason, and this you know person I provided this loan to walks away from the loan, and now I have this house valued at 50% of what it used to be worth, at least I have the Bitcoin as collateral too. That's globally liquid, and I could sell it, and I could be in a comfortable position. Changes the game, right? Like these wrapped products offered by banking institutions changes fundamentally how the traditional financial world interacts with the Bitcoin ecosystem, and offers more utility for the broader market to provide these solutions to the world. It's going to take forever. It's going to take forever. It's going to take like 4 to 8 years for this to really start happening. But what I'm excited about is like, we're going to start seeing like little headlines throughout 2025, I think, where it's like, you know, tiny little company A is now offering a Bitcoin HELOC product. And, you know, tiny little company B is now offering this, you know, pilot Bitcoin custody via JP Morgan. Or, you know, it's just going to be stuff like that. And you're going to be like, wow, that seems interesting, but it's actually a much bigger deal than a lot of people will really make of it. Everybody's focused on strategic Bitcoin reserve. It's like no brainer. That would be good for Bitcoin. But some of these other interactions with the traditional financial ecosystem, in my opinion, are more powerful and necessary for the continued expansion.
So what's bigger, the Bitcoin strategic reserve or potential of a collateralized loan product with using Bitcoin?
Collateralized loan product, 100%.
And then what do you think the impact of that would be then? You know, would it be kind of, I guess, flowed into other markets? So like you mentioned HELOCs, right? But I know like kind of as it stands now, if you have a large stock portfolio, for example, you could borrow against that at a very low interest rate and, you know, use it to fix your house or do whatever, go on a nice vacation, whatever you'd like, so you don't have to sell it off. Do you think that'll just kind of, I guess, further, you know, the economy that is Bitcoin? And two, is that something that potentially worries you with a lot of these products, I guess, coming onto line? Because we did see that last cycle with like, you know, BlockFi, FTX, some of these others. Yeah. And we saw a lot of failures happen to it. So there is a lot of risk associated with it, it seems. So it doesn't seem like it's going to be a straight road up.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about Bitcoin is meeting Bitcoiners in person. That's why I'm so excited to tell you guys about what is going on June 14th down in beautiful Tampa Bay, Florida. That's the Sound Money Soiree paired with Bitcoin Day. They're bringing a full day of great talks with amazing speakers like your boy here. And we're topping it off with a black tie event just for you and bring in that hot lady friend. We had Bitcoin cross 100K. We're all getting girlfriends, folks. So come on down to beautiful Tampa, Florida. And if you use the link below, you will get 10% off your entire order, whether you want to go to just the black tie event or black tie event plus Bitcoin Day. You'll get 10% off using the links below. Also, if you're thinking about going to BitBlock Boom in April, if you're going to Vegas in May, or if you're thinking about going to Prague in June, use my promo code GREENCANDLE for all of those. You'll get 10% off your entire order. And come bug me. I hope to see you guys very soon at one of these great in-person events. Enough from me. Back to the show.
Well, let's think about FTX for a second, right? You got a 32-year-old running an unregistered bank, taking on leverage, and he's just a tech bro sitting behind a computer, has no idea what he's doing, right? You're talking about a company that was 110% leveraged and didn't have the assets to cover the liabilities that they held on their balance sheet. That's an issue, right? Now you look at a company like JP Morgan. Okay, they've been banking for 150 years. I think they've got risk framework in place to think about what that might look like in the future. And you've got, these are different players are on the scene now, right? This isn't tech bro in his basement running an unregistered bank, offering loans that they have no idea what, like how it works. Fundamentally different players in the game. There are going to be failures, right? Like there will be companies that get too leveraged and it's going to end poorly for them for sure. 100%. It's going to happen. But there's going to be successes too. And I think strategy is a really good indicator of success, right? They rode the last bear market. And Saylor famously, you know, went on this podcast that Bitcoin's trading at $17,000 and he's like, we will ride it to zero, you know? And it was an indication that they had risk framework in place before a potential bear market because they knew it was a possibility. And now they're sitting at a position where they've got a 19% leverage ratio and sitting on $50 billion of assets. Name another company that's in that financial position. It's hard to do that, right? Like there's very few companies that have $45 billion of unencumbered capital sitting on their balance sheet. Maybe like four or five. And you're talking Mag 7, right? There are going to be companies that do poorly and get, you know, completely wrecked, but there are going to be really shining stars that are offering products that do perform really well. They've got risk framework in place. And I think it's all every company that's going to be offering these products needs to have a very strict risk framework in place. And if you're parking your Bitcoin there in these locations, like people need to be thinking about what risk frameworks do they have in place? Are these reputable companies? Are they rehypothecating capital? Like, do you feel comfortable with those types of risks? And, you know, considering that the market has been largely burned in the last bear cycles, I think everybody's going to be rethinking who they do business with.
Yeah, I hear you on that. But now that we've dived into MicroStrategy, Bitcoin, and the likes of everything else, I want to know a little bit more about Punter Jeff, man. Yeah. Where did you get the name Punter Jeff? Were you a punter in high school or college? Like, tell us a little bit about what went behind that name.
Yeah, Punter Jeff. So, I was a punter in high school and college. I also played some quarterback in high school. I also played baseball as well. I was the two-sport guy. And it was, I showed up in college and I went to my first fall baseball practice one day. And I was known as the football guy because, you know, I missed the first couple practices because I was out doing football practice, or I missed baseball practice because I was doing football practice. And I showed up and, you know, one of the seniors on the team goes, oh, hey, it's Punter Jeff. And like from that moment, well, the first practice I showed up to at baseball, it turned into I was Punter Jeff. Everybody, and it's just like wildfire through the rest of the school. And all of a sudden, boom, I was Punter Jeff. And I was like, people didn't even know my last name. That was just how they knew me. They would see me around campus. You know, that was my name. And that was all I did. And that was what I was known for. I had a 74-yard punt my senior year in college, and that was pretty cool. I had a really hard football career. In my college football career, I went 3-33. So we won three games and lost 33 games. And two of those games that we won were my freshman year. So we went defeated 2 years in a row. My sophomore year and junior year, we went defeated. So we didn't win a single game. And then we won one game my senior year. So I punted a lot. I was on the field a lot, you know, and it was awesome because I came in when the team was doing poorly and, you know, the game was never on the line and all I had to do was just like get it out of there. So yeah, it was fun. It was a good time.
Yeah. That's funny though. I mean, I guess usually as a punter, you like to not see the field, right? Because that means you're winning. But I mean, you got to be utilized a lot, which I guess is a unique aspect there. Yeah. But are you trying to compete and be the number one punter now in media? I mean, you got Pat McAfee, but I mean, you could be number two in there. It seems like punters are hot in the streets now.
Yeah, yeah, it's I am. I'm competing with Pat McAfee. I'm cool with that, right? And you know, I've got my weights behind me. I'm hitting the gym, making sure I'm strong, and yeah, I'm ready. I'm here for it. And it's cool because, you know, somebody told me like a year ago that the term punter in English, like in British slang, means like a gambler or like somebody that makes a speculative bet on financial markets. And I'm like, oh, wow, this fits both, right? I'm like making this speculative financial bet on strategy in the financial markets and Bitcoin. And, you know, I also punted. So, yeah, it's a. I like it. It's stuck, and I'm cool with keeping it.
Yeah, there we go. It seems like it's fit both sides of things. But you know, you do have more athletes kind of getting into a Bitcoin standard. I've had my friend Spencer Schrader. He's a kicker, not a punter, on the show. He announced that he's taken his signing bonus in Bitcoin, and it seems like there's a lot of other NFL athletes. Why do you think that Bitcoin is resonating with athletes so much?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, it is resonating with athletes. And when I was younger, I wanted to be a financial advisor for professional athletes because I think, you know, some of these guys rise to fame so quickly and they have no idea what to do with money. And some of them come from like really, really poor backgrounds. And then they just get all this money and they just spend it all away and are broke when they're 40. Right. Like basketball players, I think, are famous for making a ton of money and being broke by 40. Like some 80% of basketball players are broke by 40. It's like some crazy statistic. And it's incredibly appealing thinking about, you know, professional athletes starting to adopt a Bitcoin treasury or think about, you know, 10% of their income held in Bitcoin as a long term investment, thinking about it as a different, you know, exposure to these things. And I mean, some of these players, right? Like, who is it? Odell from the Seahawks, right? What's his name?
Yeah, Odell Beckham. He's on the Ravens now. I think last team he was on, and then we've had Saquon Barkley won a Super Bowl. You know, Russell Okung. We've had a couple.
That's who I was thinking about. Yeah, yeah. Okung. Yeah, so Russell Okung famously got his salary in Bitcoin like in 2019 or 2018. And, you know, just plowed it into Bitcoin. And now he's been incredibly successful, right? Like now it's gone from this, you know, small pile of cash to relatively small for him probably. And now a massive pile of cash because he's adopted this Bitcoin treasury strategy. And now he's an advocate for it, right? Like he's going to Dubai and he's talking at Bitcoin conferences. He's like talking to other athletes in the space about doing this as a way to opt out from the system. So I'm really bullish on this and potentially getting it included in college athletes' compensation, because now college athletes can get paid. And if you can start to think about these college athletes starting to take a little bit of this compensation in the form of Bitcoin and having this follow them as they rise throughout their career, that's a really foundational base to have rolling into a new financial world where you're starting to make money or not making money, right? Like a lot of these people that get drafted from college, they may, you know, fart around in the AA or AAA for 10 years and never actually make it to the big leagues. Now, if you got paid 2 Bitcoin, when you were in college and you held on to it, it doesn't matter if you ever made it to the big leagues. Like you're financially stable. And, that's an exciting future to potentially be a part of. Yeah. I'm bullish athletes potentially, adopting Bitcoin. That's really exciting.
Yeah, same here. So I wasn't a dual sport athlete. I like to say that I was a tri-sport athlete because I ran cross country, indoor and outdoor track, even though it was all the same thing basically. But, you know, got another college athlete in the building here. But Jeff, dude, I got to ask, man, you're working out back there. You had a 72-yard punt. Are we going to see a return of potentially Jeff? Are there any NFL teams out there looking for a punter that are going to sign punter Jeff here in the future?
Guys these days are so good, man. Oh my God. Some of these punters are just incredible to watch. I mean, they're hitting 80 yarders like consistently, and they're doing the like Aussie rules style football too. So they can like roll out and then kick a 65 yarder. I can't compete with that. I mean, it's just like totally crazy. It's a whole new world. But what I will say, I was really good at holding, you know, for the place kickers. That's one of the best positions on the field. Like you boom, catch it, hold it. Easy. That's a what do they call it? Like a clubhouse guy too, you know, just like fires everybody up. They've got one tiny role in the team and, you know, gets everybody excited.
Well, there we go. If we've got any NFL GMs listening, we've got a vibes guy. We could have him be the money manager for the team.
Money manager, vibes guy. Yeah.
Yeah. The holder. I mean, the trifecta there. So we'll have to get you on an NFL team or maybe in a locker room there at some point in the future. But Jeff, you've been very generous with your time. Why don't you tell people a little bit more about what you got going on and where they can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the time. This has been fun. You've asked great questions. So this has been a really, really good time. Anybody can find me. I'm on Twitter X at Punter Jeff. You know, we talk weekly about what's going on with the strategy trade. And we run this group called MSTR True North. And it happens every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. And we get online and it's a group of about 6 of us. And we talk about what's going on with MicroStrategy and Bitcoin. And we talk for about an hour and a half because it's a really interesting trade. And it's helpful to know everything that's going on in the entire market and how it may impact strategy moving forward. So some exciting things going on there. And then I do have a potential new podcast coming online here shortly, more to come there. So follow along. We've got some more things on that horizon and then potentially building out a business. So working full steam in the Bitcoin world and Bitcoin ecosystem. So there's a lot of exciting things on the horizon.
Yeah, that's awesome stuff. Well, we might have to have you back on after this new business launches and we'll have to see the podcast and everything. So let me know when all that comes out. So I'll put all that in the show notes as it comes out as well. So smash the like button, hit the subscribe button. Tell a friend to listen into Punter Jeff and more of Green Candle as well. And Jeff, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brandon. Appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.